This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. Today, we're going to commemorate Frank Gehry, who was one of the most famous and influential architects in the world. He died last week at the age of 96. Frank Gehry designed the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, which architect Philip Johnson described as the most important building of our time. He also designed the Disney Concert Hall in L.A. and Seattle's Experience Music Project, a music museum inspired by Jimi Hendrix. Gehry's work has been described as looking more like sculptures than buildings. When Scott Pelley of 60 Minutes profiled him in 2002, Pelley said, quote, "Gehry is to architecture what Einstein was to physics, what Picasso was to painting, what Jordan is to basketball," unquote. We're going to listen back to his 2004 interview with Terry Gross. At the time, his latest project was the Music Pavilion at Chicago's new 24.5-acre Millennium Park. Like his Guggenheim Museum, the exterior of his Music Pavilion has curving, billowing, floating shapes, shapes that actually are made of heavy, hard steel. Terry asked him how he started working with those steel forms.
I came into architecture at the height of modernism after the war. Decoration was a sin. Purity, functionalism, all of that stuff.
So it was an era of purity and functionalism, a lot of glass and steel high-rises.
Right, and it became very cold and inhuman and lifeless. Probably some people yearned for bringing decoration back, and they tried it for a while. I went a different route. I thought it was possible for within the aesthetics of the day to find a way to express feeling and humanistic qualities in a building. And I got interested in movement, the sense of movement, having a humanistic effect on an inert building. And there are examples in history of that. I've talked about it before. The Shiva dancing figures from India, that a multi-armed dancer in bronze, and the best ones, when you look at them and turn away and look back, you're sure they moved. I was fascinated with that sense of movement. And since our culture, when I started making my work, was a moving environment, planes, trains, cars, whatever. I talked about it and I thought about it, but I wasn't clear about it until I started experimenting quite accidentally with fish forms.
Well, let me ask you about fish. I mean, fish, fish, as we all know, have spines, but they're so flexible, and they can you know, bend and curve. What was the parallel you saw between fish and what you wanted to do in your architecture?
I was interested in movement, and I loved the drawings of Hiroshige and the Japanese woodcuts of carp, and I loved the quality of them, and I always thought they were very architectural. I also thought of fish as being on Earth 300 million years before man. And when my brethren started to regurgitate the past in the postmodern movement, as it was called, the past they were regurgitating was anthropomorphic. And I said, well, if you're going to go back, you might as well go back 300 million years before man to fish. And, you know, it was a sort of a sarcastic remark, and kind of, I didn't even realize what I was talking about when I said it. And I started drawing. Whenever I saw one of those postmodern buildings, I would angrily sketch in my book pictures of fish. And I made a 35-foot wooden fish for the a fashion house in Italy for an exhibit. And the 35-foot wooden fish was very kitsch and very embarrassing-looking object. But when you stood beside it, it had the same character that the Shiva dancing figure. You turned away and looked, and you thought it moved. And so, quite accidentally, I found myself into a language that I was really looking to find. And like everything else, it happens by accident.
So you were looking to find a way of making something very stable.
That expressed movement,
and you found it through the form of the fish. And how does that connect to the forms that you've used in recent architecture?
Well, I then made shapes. I started to say, what could I do to this wooden fish that would make it less embarrassing as a piece of kitsch? And I cut off the tail, and I cut off the head, and I cut off the fins, and I started to abstract it. And I made a shape, an abstracted, let's call it a fillet of fish, that I used in a show, an exhibit I did at the Walker Art Museum. And it still had that quality of movement when you looked back and looked around. And I made that out of a wooden frame and covered it with metal. And so that was the beginning of a language. And I took that language into the buildings.
But, you know, in some of your buildings, including the new Pritzker Pavilion in Chicago and the Disney Concert Hall and the Guggenheim Museum, those kinds of curving shapes, they're not made out of wood. I mean, they're made out of steel or titanium. And how did you realize that would be, how did you start working with titanium as a medium for something that would be really firm and stable, strong, but also moldable? And not moldable, I guess it's more, I don't know, are you molding it or are you,
yeah.
How are you getting the shape?
Okay, here's how you do it. I do maybe 50 models. They look, sometimes they look like crumpled paper, so people think I crumple up paper and that's how they get there. And I do, and I analyze the shapes and as though they're structures with the computer to determine whether I'm within the budgetary constraints. And over time, I slowly evolve these shapes and refine them. And then you got to decide what skin to put on it, the exterior surface. A long time ago, you know, buildings are a wall and a roof, right?
Mm-hmm.
And usually the wall is a different material than the roof. And I wanted, a long time ago, tried to make the buildings into one shape. I thought if I could make it one piece, that I would have a lot of flexibility. So I, metal roofing is tradition for centuries. And there's a tradition, and there's a detailing tradition, and there's a performance tradition, so that you can rely on it not to leak, not to get you in trouble, if you follow the rules of it. I started making the whole building. I started to take the roofing material down and make the walls part of the roofing material. Hmm. So it all was one material. And the choices then were copper, and then you have stainless steel, and you're pretty much limited to a palette like that. Now, copper, when you put it on a building, turns very dark for about 10 years and is kind of morose. So it's, unless you pre-green it, and when you pre-green it, it looks kind of phony to me. So so I reject that, and I started using stainless steel.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go to Bilbao and you use stainless steel, Bilbao is a city that has a lot of rain and a lot of gray skies, and stainless steel in gray skies goes dead. You'll see that the stainless steel in Millennium Park will go quiet when it's cloudy. It won't shine.
Because it's so reflective, so it can reflect the sky.
Yeah, it reflects the sky. And mm-hmm. if the sky is gray, it reflects the gray sky, and it goes gray. In Bilbao, that would have been difficult, and I found titanium by accident that in a gray sky, it turns golden and shines. And so I used it in Bilbao. It's very expensive. The reason I didn't use it here, it would have increased the budget by a lot of money. And since these shapes were not, it wasn't one whole building, they were mostly vertical, I think they'll be okay.
I want to read you a list of descriptions of the Guggenheim Museum that you built in Bilbao, Spain, as written by journalists. A pile of improbably huge fish, fractured tinfoil flowers, a fantastic dream ship, all sails, full sweeping upstream, Marilyn Monroe's wind-assisted skirts, an exploded artichoke heart, vast hulls of a ship that used to loom over a shipbuilding town, a prehistoric beast advancing with leg and foot toward the water, an explosion in a sardine factory, a monstrous flower, a fairy tale castle. What do you think?
Yeah, it's fine. I try to describe it, but not in those kind of terms, no.
You were born in Toronto, and for 4 years you moved with your family to a small mining town in Canada called Timmins.
Timmins, Ontario.
Yeah, where your father worked for the distributor of slot machines and pinball machines. And, boy, old pinball machines were so great. I mean, they were kind of like billboards or neon signs. They were like things that would light up and all kinds of like pictures and stuff. Did you love the design of those pinball machines?
They were always in the basement somewhere in my house. And I used to play with them and help them fix them and stuff like that. Yeah, I guess so.
Mm-hmm.
When you go through a childhood like that, and it was a tough one because there were tough times for the family, and you tend to want to cut that part of your life off.
So you don't think about it very much.
Forget about it. But he was involved with the carnival business, and in a way, and used to bring those kind of people home. And as a kid, I met a lot of them, and there was a blind boxer, black guy that used to babysit me, I remember. The good thing about it all was the mix of people that I was exposed to as a kid, which has helped me in life. I mean,
one thing I think you have not forgotten about from that period, you've said that you were exposed to a lot of anti-Semitism in this small mining town. And did that contribute to the fact that you changed your name when you became an architect from Goldberg to Gary?
Well, it was a factor in allowing myself to be convinced by my ex-wife that it was the most important thing to do, I guess. I didn't like the idea of changing it.
Why was it so important to her?
We were going to have our first child, and there had been a lot of anti-Semitism. She experienced, and she said she didn't want to bring a kid into the world to go through that. The name at that time was a caricature. There was a radio program called The Goldbergs that caricatured. And I took a lot of heat for it. And, I didn't want to do it. My father hated me for letting her do it. My mother went along with it. After she did it, I was so embarrassed. Every time I met somebody, I told them.
But you wouldn't go back to Goldberg now, too late, right?
Well, I'm married to a Panamanian girl, Berta, who threatens to go back to Goldberg. She'd like to be Berta Goldberg, she says. But I doubt if we'll do it.
Well, you've made the Gary name too famous.
I think my kids, my son Sam, flirts with it because he wants to be an architect, so he may just want to get rid of the Gary name for a while.
Now, your first building that really got a lot of attention and that ended up being pretty controversial was your own home. You had moved into a small two-story cottage. Is that a fair word for it? You kind of designed a new home around it. And if you look at it, like in a photograph, you have this like two-story building, and then around that, you have there's sheet metal and plywood.
Corrugated metal.
Corrugated metal. And then on the second story, there's like chain link fencing around it. And it almost looks more like an assemblage, you know, like an assemblage sculpture than architecture, because there's so many, it's so mixed media. And it the textures all seem to be kind of conflicting, and you're not really sure what is the purpose of the chain link fence on the second floor. Is there a purpose for it? Is it just there as like another material to contrast with the other materials?
Well, there was a purpose when I did it.
What was the purpose?
The kid was 2 years old, and his room had a door to the outside, to the terrace, and the first day I was there, he started climbing down the wall. And so we put up the chain link fence with the idea that it would be safe. It'd be like a safety place for him to play on the top, on the upstairs, outdoors of his room. And then once I committed myself to doing that, I then started to do things with the way it looked, I guess, and proportioned it. But
yeah, with some pretty odd angles, right?
Yeah. Well, I started doing that. But yeah. I had played with it because chain link is the most despised material ever. People hate it. And yet they use it so prevalently all over the world. And I was trying to figure out how it could be so despised and yet so used and so so much denial about it that people use it, and then they say, well, no, that's a tennis court, but it's a damn chain link fence. So I decided to study. I liked that idea of things that people deny exist, and tried to see if I could figure out a way to make it better or usable. If since they were going to use it anyway, maybe I could help them make it look prettier. And I started to explore the qualities of it that I thought were, as a material, like it works like a scrim. If you look at it straight on, you look through it. If you look at it on the angle, it closes up like a scrim does.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different weights of it and different coatings on it. And so I did a whole lot of research on it. By the time I got to the house, I was playing with it. I had the beginning of a language with it.
Do you still live in that house?
Yes.
Still have the chain link fence on the second floor?
Yes.
Even though there's no baby?
He climbed over the chain link. It didn't work. He climbed over it.
When he got a little older?
No, right away. He was
really?
up over it and out.
That's some athletic baby you had there.
Yeah, he was something.
So do you still, what are your gut feelings now about chain link?
Well, I don't use it very much, even though I've figured out how to use it. People sometimes ask me to use it, and I refuse, but I've done some things with it. I'm not against it. I haven't been too interested in it. We are designing a new house, though. I am.
Oh, you're designing a new house for yourself?
Yeah, from scratch.
Where?
In Venice, California, and I'm working on it now. So.
What's the most important thing you want that you don't have now?
A garden. I bought a piece of land that'll give me a garden.
That's nice. And will there be a kind of architectural design around the garden? Or?
Yeah, I'm doing a, it's a half-acre lot, and so I'm building several pavilions.
Oh.
More like the Philip Johnson House in New Canaan, where there's a living room, and then there's a separate room, a building for bedrooms and stuff.
Huh. So it'll be like two separate houses?
Yeah.
Why do you want that?
I'd like to live in the garden.
Okay.
More outdoors. You can do that in L.A.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Congratulations on the completion of the Pritzker Pavilion, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Frank Gehry speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. The world-famous architect died last week. He was 96 years old.